The Culinary Libertarian Podcast, episode 17.
Welcome to the Culinary Libertarian Podcast, where the philosophy is free, but the food is on you.
Hello, folks. Welcome back to the podcast. Dan Reed here. Happy to have you back. Take a minute to head on out to my podcasts page, culinarylibertarian.com/podcasts. And there you'll find all of my icons for various social media sites, including the new one, bitbacker.io. You can also subscribe to my YouTube page, and I've got the audios of the podcasts up on the YouTube page. Also, do please consider being a patron at my Patreon account. I've got some items for various levels of support, a bumper sticker or a mug for the different levels. And lastly, find and like and rate the show on Apple Podcasts and leave a positive comment. The more comments I get, the higher the show moves up in the rankings, and the higher the show gets, the more people who find the show, the more people who get cooking. Today, my guest is Robin Lawrence. She is the author of the Cannabis Kitchen Cookbook, and we're going to discuss, well, the actual for real applications of cooking with cannabis and why that would be a good thing. Now, if you are of a particular age, you remember all of the movies, the brownies, man. Well, yeah, it's funny. It's fun. It's great fun to watch. Cheech and Chong were hilarious, but the science of cannabis and the science of healing with cannabis have come miles from the buffoonery of 70s movies, and people like Robin are pushing forward with the idea that health can be achieved and maintained by cooking with cannabis. You can find information about Robin's book at the show notes page, culinarylibertarian.com/17. Welcome, Robin.
Thank you.
So before we get into talking about your book, tell us a little bit about your journey to cannabis, because I did a little reading and you have an interesting background in some holistic lifestyle knowledge. And so share that with us and tell us how we get from there to here.
Well, it's a journey that sometimes people are a little bit puzzled, but in my mind, and hopefully after I explain it all, it will make sense. So for a good 11 years, I started a magazine in 1999 called Natural Home. And before that, I had been, for a long time, a green lifestyle journalist and covering natural medicine, herbs, holistic things like that. So Natural Home had a great long run, 11 years. And, basically we ended in 2011. We started it in 1999. And that was a time when not many people really were paying a lot of attention to green lifestyles yet. And organic food was really just becoming a thing. And so it was really just, we had a great ride. And we really, just really got a chance to open up the conversation about green lifestyles in this country. And to the point, where it did become pretty mainstream. So, that was an amazing journey. 2008 was not kind to magazines, particularly when focused on the home. So Natural Home went away, and I had that kind of career moment where it was like, okay, you get to reinvent yourself, and what is it, what's your next passion? What's the next thing? And I had been introduced to cannabis as a patient. It helped me with dysmenorrhea, which is severe cramping. And so I had, I didn't know that much about it before I came to it, but I knew a ton about herbs and, herbal medicine and all of that. And it just clicked for me and it made so much sense. And, I really, the more I learned about why it was not available to the people who needed it, and, the ridiculous reasons for prohibition, all of it, it just really, it became, I knew it was my next passion and what I really needed to kind of use what I have to offer the world to kind of help have happen. So, you know, that's really for the past 5 years, what I've been focusing on is making sure that we can get this natural plant. It's a plant is when it comes down to it, you know, to the people who need it. And living in the Denver area, I got to know so many people who, you know, patients who had moved to my state just so they could access the only medicine that would help them. And so that's really, you know, the long-winded version of how I got to from, you know, being natural home green girl to being cannabis green girl. So that's the journey.
So I'm sure in mentioning even the word cannabis, I think still elicits the little guffaws, and we all remember the Cheech and Chong, good brownies, man.
Absolutely.
It's hard, I suppose, not to go to that sort of stereotype. The answer, of course, is obvious, but I want you to elaborate. What are the savory uses for cannabis other than just, you know, the dessert of, hey, man, I made some brownies?
The brownie. You know, it was actually what I did when I first put together a cookbook. I was like, we're not going to put a brownie in. And then we finally did. And we made a really, you know, healthy goji berry, like yummy decadent brownie. But just because of that stereotype, because it is so prevalent there. And, you know, everybody's also eaten too much of one of those brownies and probably had a terrible experience, or a lot of people have. So there's a lot of stigma there around the brownie. And the fact is that when you are cooking with cannabis, basically there's a very simple scientific process. You want to pull the cannabinoids, the THC and the CBD are the primary ones that most everybody's after these days. And you want to pull those. And because they're fat soluble, you need to pull them using a fat. So you use an oil or a butter. You can even use milk or cream. And then you need to convert the THCA, which is the THC is acid in the, or whatever the cannabinoid acid in the raw plant, to just a regular THC, which activates the cannabinoids and makes them work for you. And so you need to do that using heat. So as long as you can put your cannabis flower into any fat, heat it up for, you know, at a very low temperature for a long time, and then you can use that to make anything. So I think that's a thing that people don't realize. You can make, you know, you can make cheese, you know, you can make tuna, you can make a sauce, you can make, I also like to use the flour, you know, the leaves and, you know, make pestos and things like that. So I think it's just a matter of getting past that. It must be sweet. That's one of the reasons I got into this is I don't really eat a lot of sugar. So I needed to find alternatives where I could, you know, eat my regular healthy food and not be adding a lot of sugar to my diet because I wanted to get my cannabinoids. So it's really, yeah, it's so versatile. It works for anything. And now in legal states, you can get it water-soluble powders or liquids that you simply add to whatever, soup, anything.
Wow. Well, so that is just so much more than I even understand. And so I'm just going to say, I'm just a plebe about this stuff. I mean, I went to high school, I went to college. So I have that sort of just rudimentary exposure to here, let's, you know, have a joint at the party. So you made a comment. And so this is something I didn't know. So you said, I even used the leaves. So my first thought is, well, hang on. So if the leaves are your secondary source, what is the primary source that cannabis cooks and CBD and THC seekers, what are they using? Where is it coming from?
That's coming from what they call the flower, or, you know, most people call it the bud, but technically it is called the flower. And it's coming from what are called trichomes inside the flower, or that's really the resin. So you know how when you get a flower and it's really sticky and it's got that nice smell, that's the resin, and that's where all the trichomes are, where all the cannabinoids are located. So that's where you're going to be pulling from if you want to get the effects from the cannabinoids, okay? But, you know, like, so, for example, you know, if you want to get the psychoactive effects, you're going to want to pull from the flower. The leaves, eating the leaves will not get you high, but it will give you a ton of amazing health benefits. So this is where you can get, you know, really just all the raw cannabinoids, you get all the nutrients from the plant. I mean, technically, cannabis is a vegetable. Right? So, you know, it is full, it's packed with nutrients. And, you know, so this is something that is becoming really popular these days for people who want to get all the benefits and the health benefits and the nutrient benefits, but they don't want to walk around high all day. You know, what I do is just juice the leaves, and I can get all of the good stuff without, you know, having to deal with kind of a foggy mind.
Well, so, I mean, yeah, I mean, it gives a whole new meaning to the idea of eating your leafy greens.
Yes, it does. Yes, it does.
So just so I understand, I want to make sure I get this. Cooking doesn't have a deleterious effect on the THC, but you have to take a step or two in the first place to make it available to the food you're going to use.
Correct. Yes. So you need to, what they call the process of heating it up to convert the acid to THC is called decarboxylation. And that is something that, yes, if you want to get the psychoactive effects and really activate your cannabinoids, you will need to do. The one thing you don't want to do is cook anything, any of your cannabis food up above about 280 degrees or so, because it will start then to degrade your cannabinoids. So, you know, just trying to keep that temperature usually as low as possible is, you know, is the best way to go.
So you would, so having cooked a lot, one of the things that I know chefs do, at least at the high-end restaurants, is we'll take a piece of meat in a pan, mm-hmm. and add some water to the pan, and then they baste it. Ooh. But that's pretty high heat. So if I took some fresh chopped cannabis leaves, put them in that oil and the butter that's becoming a brown butter, so that's about 400 degrees, I might get some flavor imparted onto the outside of the meat. But as far as any healthful benefits go, that's been destroyed because the pan is just too hot.
Correct.
Interesting. That I had no idea about that.
Yes. Well, you need to, it's interesting, like, so that there's a window, right? So to decarb it, to get the, you know, to pull the THC into, to convert it to the THC acid, you need to be right around 180 to 2. But then you don't, once you're using that, you know, whatever you make that into to cook the dish, you just don't want to go above, you know, about 300.
Okay. Because I'm thinking that I know that most breads, you know, bakers, they check for bread doneness with a thump test, but that's just because their ears are experienced to the sound they want to hear.
Right.
For bakers who are learning, mm-hmm. you use the thermometer, and bread is done at 180 degrees, but that sounds like we're right at getting kind of close to the threshold of an acceptable temperature for healthy cannabis use.
Yes, definitely. You know, and the most interesting thing when you talk about the thumb test, because you can't really do a test with cannabis food like this. You can't test your oil and know immediately because it takes a half an hour at least to come on, right? So you can't be, you know, like, all right, that's too strong. It'll be a half hour later.
Amazing. All right. You know, back to my actually junior high days when I first was experiencing people, students walking around talking about Sinsemillion this or Hawaiian that, you know, there was a handful of names or I guess strains or varieties, and my vernacular is poor. Nowadays, is the cannabis industry just overwhelmed with a variety of strains or kinds or something?
I mean, I think the innovation in this industry is beyond anything that I've ever seen. It's amazing. And I think we're going to see more and more and more of this as, you know, just as it's exponentially going to move as it, you know, becomes more and more legal. But I think the first thing, you know, for me in 2009, when I first became a patient, I was so amazed when I walked. That's when I didn't even know you could eat it, you know, we could really eat it. And so, you know, when I saw these strains, it was like chocolope and blueberry and all of these like amazing. I was like, wait, what? So there's, I mean, I think one of the most fun jobs in the industry would be probably to name strains. There's some really good ones. But yes, there's a proliferation. The genetics are amazing. You know, one of the things that almost happened during Prohibition is that we basically almost bred out CBD out of the plant, which now, you know, as we know, that's what everybody wants. That's becoming the darling of this industry. So the innovation, the genetics, you know, just everything that they're able to do now with the plant itself is unbelievable. You know, now what's starting to happen is the technology's taking over, right? So they're taking the plant apart, and they're isolating different cannabinoids and different terpenes, and then they're putting it back together in a way that they think, you know, will be more effective. You know, and I mentioned too the water soluble powders and liquids, like that changes the whole game. All of a sudden, you can just add something to your food. You don't even have to worry about fat solubility or making oil or any of it. So I just think, you know, it's exploding. I've just, every time you turn around, there's some new concentrate or crazy way of doing things that you're just like, the next thing that's going to happen too is concentrates are going to just go crazy. They're already becoming the best-selling thing and starting to outsell flour. So it's all moving. It's all moving as it does, you know, toward a more processed, I guess, environment is what we're seeing, which is what happens in all industries.
Right. So all of these new things, these are hybridized.
Yes.
Okay. And so just call them the growers or the researchers that are doing this. Are they also able with this manipulation to control or increase the level of THC and, aside from the obvious, more powerful joint?
Mm-hmm.
To what benefit does that bring?
You know, I mean, I think a lot of the super, super high THC concentrates were really created for patients in mind. You know, patients who really, really needed a lot of pain control, you know, pain management. And so I think that's really who benefits the most from that. You know, these days, your average concentrate is up at like 85% THC, which is just huge. But, you know, flower itself is so much stronger than it used to be. You know, back in our day, back in those high school days, it was 3 to 5% THC. And these days, the average you'll get, you know, in a dispensary is 25 to 35%. So again, just the flower itself is that much stronger.
That's, I mean, the only comparison I can make that's at least relative, although I'm not sure how actually relatable it is to go from, say, a Coors Light beer at possibly 4 or 5% alcohol to a Madeira or a good port, which is fortified at about 28%. And there's a substantial change in the alcohol and the impact on your body. So it's the best I got.
I like that. That's perfect. I might steal that, Dan.
No such thing as intellectual property.
It's a good one.
A friend of mine, Rachel Kennerly, she produces a podcast called Cannabis Heals Me. And she has guests on who share their success stories with cannabis in various diseases or ailments. I don't want to pigeonhole too much. So let me formulate my idea concisely. Are researchers formulating plants to deal with a specific issue or what? How are they addressing the needs of the medical community?
Yeah, you know, I mean, there definitely are, you know, services or, you know, places you can go where, you can, you know, get recommendations for strains that will be, you know, that will work well with whatever your condition is. We are seeing a lot of, you know, now that, you know, the thing is we didn't understand the plant all that well until, because nobody was ever able to research it. And so now we're starting to understand that it's not just THC and CBD, but it's that also the terpene profile in those plants make a huge difference, perhaps as huge as anything else. And so what you're starting to see is a lot of breeding for specific terpene profiles. And so, you know, which will say, you know, if you're someone who needs, you know, something that's a little more kind of, you know, soporific, that's put more sleepy, you'll get something with, you know, more of like a you know, just something that will make you. So basically, yes, yes, that is happening. And they're doing it not just with THC and CBD, but with, you know, every part of the plant, understanding how it all works together. There's something they call the entourage effect, which is basically like, don't isolate out these various parts of it. You know, THC on its own is not going to work as well for someone as the full profile, the whole plant, and the terpenes that went into there, and the flavonoids and everything else. So it's, you know, it's like in any good holistic eating or medicine. Don't isolate, but try to use the whole plant.
Well, you make an interesting point that I've been reading about the American diet, mm-hmm. and there has been such a focus on finding the one thing that's making Americans fat instead of focusing on the aggregate of it all. Somehow the vast quantity of everything we eat is all all boils down to one thing, which of course is not true. But I want to ask you another question because you did bring up terpenes. Are terpenes naturally occurring in other plants?
They are. Terpenes naturally occur in, you know, pretty much every aromatic plant, right? So, you know, pine trees, lemons, citrus. So they are pine, you know, pine nuts, peppercorns. So they are, well, they are particularly concentrated. You know, cannabis is particularly rich in them. And it really is, they really are what kind of give it so much of its kind of personality, I guess I would say. So they are definitely in all other plants. And they're just, you know, kind of more prevalent here. And, you know, so a lot of people will do things like they will eat peppercorns if they've, you know, eaten too, if they think that they are too high, because there's about pinene in there that can counteract that is, you know, can kind of counteract the THC. So there's all sorts of things as we start to understand how they work in it, that we can play more even with it, and how you're combining it with other foods and stuff and recipes as well. And that to me is where this gets really fun.
Robin, let's take a minute out for a word from one of my affiliates. Folks, if cannabis is not something you can get where you live, but CBD is something you know will help you with your anxiety or your pain or your other issues, then check out Okana CBD Oil. They are made in Colorado and should be available in all 50 states. It is THC-free. It goes through a multiple filtering process to make sure you're getting pure CBD oil with no side effects and no prescriptions necessary, and they ship right to your house. If you can't do the cooking, at least get the treatment. Okana CBD Oil at culinarylibertarian.com/CBD. That's culinarylibertarian.com/CBD to get your risk-free bottle. Cool. I had run across this idea somewhere about canna honey. So I was interested in that, and I did a little bit of research and just a little bit. And my first few indications are that cannabis doesn't need bees.
Right.
So my first thought was, then what's going on here? Someone's mentioning canna honey, but it doesn't sound like that's even a thing. So what's canna honey?
You know, canna honey, I have a recipe for it in the cookbook. You can basically, it's just pretty much that same process that I just explained to you, but you do it with honey. And the honey acts as the fat, basically. So, you know, there's that. There's also, you know, I have to pull out, I just wrote a history book, and so my mind is full of facts, but there is in Central America somewhere, there are people who keep bees by their, you know, cannabis plants and, you know, kind of call that cannabis honey, but it's not going to get you high or anything. It's just going to be like, you know, a clover honey or any local honey where it's the, you know, but you're not going to get that kind of transfer. I think when they're talking about canna honey, they're talking about just the cannabis infused honey.
Okay. Well, that makes more sense.
Yes. Yes.
All right, so let's turn a little bit sort of, well, at least fairly recently topical news. In light of the recently departed Jeff Sessions, boo, and his he had some very strong feelings that cannabis is the gateway to hell, emphasis is mine. How do you address the don't do drugs propaganda? Certainly, I'm sure that somewhere in the world there are very addictive and dangerous drugs. Why do you, and this is, I guess, the question for the ages, why do you think cannabis is singled out when it doesn't really fit any of those categories?
I think there are a lot of, you know, political reasons going back to why prohibition started in the first place. And it has, less to do really with marijuana, which is a very racist term that they made up in order to make it seem really scary, and foreign, right? So, you know, when there are different theories, I kind of subscribe a little bit to the one that, it is, the same plant as the hemp plant, which is a wonderful source of paper and was a wonderful source of, you know, fiber and a lot of the things that the plastics industry and the Hearst family with, you know, all of their timber riches didn't want. So, you know, there's that theory. There are, you know, it's just, there's a lot of it. So it was, you know, it was definitely a way to, and, you know, they're actually, there's actually confessions from the Nixon administration saying this, you know, look, we couldn't go after the hippies and, you know, the Black Panthers, but if we made this illegal, then we could get them that way. Right. So, you know, that's a part of where the propaganda came from. It's, you know, it's really a lot about just, and it's been down through the ages. I just wrote a history book of eating cannabis, you know, and it goes all the way back to ancient, you know, ancient Islam, when it was a way of keeping the masses down. You know, it was, cannabis was something that the masses used, that the main common people used, because, you know, life was hard. And so it made it a little bit nicer and a little bit easier. And if you can persecute them for that thing, you can control them. And that's the way it's been pretty much through the ages. And, you know, that's what I hope are finally coming out of now. But there's a lot of people that just want to hang on to that because it's an easy way to control people.
Well, I think that that's probably true. And so there's a few things that, you know, being a food guy, I know a few things about food that some people may not know. Cyanide is a naturally occurring poison in peach pits.
Mm-hmm.
Oxalic acid on rhubarb leaves can be toxic levels.
Uh-huh.
And yet I don't see anybody driving around neighborhoods making people stop eating peaches or arresting them for buying peaches or apricots. I don't see lawn maintenance crews going out and destroying wild rhubarb, which as kids we used to eat sour as can be, but we all knew,
right?
You don't eat the leaves and just don't do that. And so whether or not it was true, there was always the urban myth that the girl on the other block ate the leaves and got sick. So, you know, it was effective and nobody got sick and, you know, it made good pie. So,
you know, and I think the thing, coffee, what's one of the most addicting substances in our culture is coffee. That's not illegal. You know, that's readily available. It's a plant, just like this one, you know.
And tobacco.
And tobacco, you know, again, a plant just like this one, you know. But I'm, you know, I'm kind of, you know, of your philosophy with the libertarian thing here that, you know, I mean, we all need to be responsible for ourselves. And when it comes down to it, it's not the substance, it's the person. So it's, you know, you can't blame the substance for what the person chooses to do with it. And I think that, you know, I think that's kind of true of any of this, right? You know, you look at places like Portugal where they've experimented with, you know, decriminalizing a little bit and they're solving their problems.
Well, I think you're right about that. But, you know, this is not where we're going to go with the show, but if you make the society accountable, each person for his or her own actions,
yes,
then you've almost immediately invalidated the need for government, and that's not going to happen. Not without revolution.
Yeah.
Sorry. The dog whistle for everybody. All right. So then let's kind of get this a little bit easier. What do you think the general public gets wrong about cannabis that you haven't already covered, and what are your refutations for that argument?
Woo, wow. You said this was going to be easier, huh?
I lied.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I do think, I mean, there is still that, just that ridiculous stereo. Well, first of all, yeah, I think they get kind of everything wrong. Because I think there's that stereo, you know, that stigma that got stuck to it way back when, who knows why, that it's going to make you into this couch potato and unmotivate you and your life.
Well, Cheech and Chong.
Right? That's just, you know, I mean, there's a whole industry now that can prove that wrong. Right? You know, so I think that may be the biggest one. And, you know, it's interesting because when I first got into this industry 5 years ago, I was, and, you know, still to some extent am, but I really was then so hypervigilant about making sure that I could overcome that and prove to them that I was not that stoner. And, you know, so I would show up early and, you know, make sure that I did extra and all that kind of stuff because I wanted to combat that so much. Because it really is like, oh, yeah. And so if you make any sort of mistake, it's like, yeah, that's just because you're a stoner, right? So I think that idea that it makes you not as smart and slow is really wrong. It's just wrong. I know so many people who, you know, it works for them just like Ritalin works for, you know, the younger generations. So I think that to me is one of the biggest ones. And I also think that people do not understand what how valuable it can be as medicine. And we do in Colorado because we've been surrounded by it. But I was giving a speech in Chicago and I was talking about this, and you could see that people were kind of a little shaking their heads and a little bit skeptical, like, oh yeah, sure, it's medicine. So I think we need to really let people know that this, that there's real science behind this and that it really is to help alert.
Well, I think that you're right about the shaking the head part. I mean, I know that you're right. I'm not doubting your observation, but I think this is another thread for another show, but there is a lot of power in the thug agencies of the USDA and the FDA.
Absolutely.
And people, I think, put a tremendous amount of weight behind them when I don't think that they have earned the weight of the public opinion, especially in terms of the harm the FDA does in its attempt to do good. Now, I think there's probably really decent people who work there, so I don't mean to malign the individuals, but when it takes 11 to 14 years to get a drug approved and all of the delicate little dance that's required to go through that, and that they can throw food away because it doesn't have a purple sticker on it, yet the farmers who raised the food, who knows better about food than the farmer who raised it? And to suggest that they don't know what's good and what's bad is but some guy driving a desk in a city in another state, well, that person is imbued with all of the knowledge of the universe. Well, that's fairly silly. And I think if we explained it to people in terms of recognizing the infallibility of the desk jockey, we might have some success, at least in opening the possibility of changing minds.
Yes. Yes. Well, you know, it'll come. It will come. I mean, I think that the genie's definitely out of the bottle at this point, you know? I mean, so I think at least probably everybody has heard something, or, you know, knows someone who knows someone who has, you know, been positively affected by this, you know, and you know, their grandma who, you know, had it after surgery or whatever. So it's starting to happen. But, you know, we're looking at decades and decades and decades of, you know, the people in the, you know, positions of power at the DEA and the FDA and whatever, putting this out. So we've got there's a lot of work to be done. And we need to be careful on how we do it. You know, what scares me is that we have people out there saying that it'll do everything from cure cancer to, you know, brain tumors to, you know, whatever. And if we start just throwing out all of this stuff without any science and research to back it, then people won't believe us. So we have to, you know, make this case, but also with, you know, caution and credibility.
Yes, then the boasts aren't any better than the detractors.
Exactly. That's a good short way of putting that.
So people who live in states where cannabis isn't legal or it's getting there, what can people do at their own level to move the ball down the field, to borrow a sports analogy?
Mm-hmm.
How can they affect a change to make cannabis legal where they are?
I mean, I think the most important, you know, it's like, you know, it's grassroots. It's just gotten on the ballot, you know, whether it's in your city, your state, you know, and it's, you know, the most successful way that people have done it is to, you know, do the ballot initiative. So we did see Vermont do that without a vote, which is pretty exciting. So, but I think really the most important thing is just, you know, yeah, you've got to, you know, start educating people in your state and getting it, you know, getting it to the vote. There are so many states now that I never thought we would see turning that are now have voted in medical because, and again, I think it's a matter of it's the education and people knowing someone in perhaps a legal state who had helped. So, yeah, I think it's just grassroots. It's where it's going to come from. Yeah. I mean, although, you know, you never know. The hemp bill just passed, or I mean, the farm bill just passed, which legalized hemp, right? And so my thought is that within the next couple of years, at any moment, this could also just federally pass. I think we're so close.
Well, not this week because there's no government.
That's right. Here we go.
In your book, you worked with a handful of chefs, about a dozen, if I recall.
That is correct.
What restrictions that you are aware of do those chefs deal with when cooking with cannabis? And mostly I'm thinking on a legal aspect, not from a culinary standpoint, but what steps of authority do they have to contend with, if any?
No, they have. I mean, not one of them has been able to open their own restaurant doing it yet, which is pretty sad. But they, you know, basically there's no social public consumption anywhere. California is starting to change that a bit, but it's, you know, slow going. And it's, I think West Hollywood is the only place where it's actually happening. So, you know, that's a problem. So basically you have to, it has to be all private catering. And they have to, you know, basically what most of them are doing is working with private clients. I also do some private catering through, I have like a CK events business. And the way we do it is, we have the people that we are working with, they must purchase their own cannabis. So, you know, we make sure that they purchased it, that, you know, they are paying the taxes on it and all of that. Because, you know, it's just, you've got to be, you know, it's a gray area still. And we have to be so careful. So everyone I know is pretty much, you know, just making sure that we are not in any way, form, or whatever, providing cannabis to people. That's what we still have to do, which is, it's interesting because we don't have to do that, say, when we bring a bottle of champagne. But this is where we are right now.
Well, you have an age restriction on cigarettes and champagne.
Correct. But I mean, you know, we just cannot even provide the cannabis at all. So we, you know, have them go to the dispensary and pick it up themselves because, yeah.
So in that scenario where the clients bring in the cannabis, giving it to you or giving it to the cook, I would imagine that a state that wanted to be a real pain in the behind could create a chain of custody situation where now that it's been given to the cook, I can only imagine that they would enforce some idiocy because they can. Has that been a problem in your experience?
It hasn't. You know, I think all of the chefs that I have never, ever, and I'm in a lot of, you know, like, you know, Instagram circles and stuff like that with cannabis chefs. And nobody has ever said that anything like that has happened. The biggest deal really for cannabis chefs is that their websites keep, you know, Facebook keeps shutting them down. Instagram won't look post, right? You know, all of a sudden it'll just be so random. One day it'll just be like, yep, done with you. And, you know, suddenly they have to start all over again, building a whole new following. And it's kind of a big deal when you lose that following that you built. So, but you know, as far as the actual working with the plant, I think everybody's been super careful and knows, you know, kind of what we need to go through. And I think that the states, they just have bigger issues, right? I mean, we're not, I guess if there were terrible things that were happening and people were coming away and ODing and all this kind of stuff, they probably would crack down, or maybe they would. But I really believe that the state officials in the states that have passed this, they're not our enemies by any means. You know, they really want to see this work, and they're seeing the tax dollars it's bringing to the states. And this is, you know, a thriving industry that they're not really wanting to, you know, to hold back in any way. They want to make sure that regulations are followed.
Right. Well, okay. That makes sense. Well, that's good. It's good to know that they're not just being meanie pants because they can be.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I really don't think they are, you know, and it's been interesting that they've, you know, there have been some pretty high profile, like, you know, where they've busted some dispensaries that were not following regulations. But, you know, I mean, it's they were not following the regulations. So I think it's, you know, when something is this new and this controversial, you have to be twice, 10 times as buttoned up. Right? Just because everybody's watching. So I think that's where most of the chefs that I know who are doing this are pretty much on that same boat.
Cool. Very good. Well, since this is a culinary show, and since I've got you here, I've started a couple episodes ago a new little bit, which I stole the idea from my friend Nikki P at Sounds Like Liberty. And if you've ever watched the TV show Inside the Actor's Studio, you know, at the end, James Lipton asks a few questions.
Okay.
So I'm going to ask you a few questions, and
okay,
they're very open-ended, and answer however you wish. There's really no rule. First one is, what is your favorite food?
I have so many favorite foods. But I guess I would have to say that if there were one go-to, it would be, it's so simple, but it's a simple butter tomato sauce that is made using basically only butters, tomato, and salt. The recipe I got from Marcella Hazan, and it is to die for. Although, okay, yes, I have to say one more. So also morel mushrooms in the spring.
Oh, yes. I'm with you on that one.
Yep, saute just in a little butter with a little rhubarb sauce on the side. That would probably be my last meal.
Nice, nice, nice. Well, I'm going to go hunting for them in the mountains of Oregon in a few months. So.
Oh, nice. I found my first one in Colorado last year. I couldn't believe it. So.
Yes.
Yeah. And I know. It's amazing. I grew up in Iowa. So, you know, we would go out and gather, you know, trash sacks of the things. And so I couldn't, when I moved out of there, I was like, wait, these are $35 a pound? Like, what? So.
Yeah, or more.
Uh-huh. Yeah, now. That was 20 years ago. But I know. So it's amazing. Yeah, but no, that's definitely. And, you know, I think that's the way I eat, though, is it's always a seasonal. It's like whatever is the best thing of that season is what I'm going to want.
Fair enough. What is your least favorite food?
Liver.
All right. What gets you excited?
Oh, man. What gets me excited? Oh, so many things. I love to travel. That's kind of my life right now. I'm just, I sold my house and I'm just traveling around. I love great food with great people. I love community. I love people working together in community to make a difference. I love creating. You know, I love the whole process of, writing a book and seeing it come together and marketing it and getting out there. So yeah. And, you know, of course I get excited about my kids. Just whenever I get to hang with them, even though they're 20 and 24 now. Yeah. You know, they'll always be priority. It never goes. So yeah.
Yeah. Good answer. No, I understand. I get it. What is your biggest turnoff?
Closed-mindedness.
All right. What sound or noise do you love?
Oh, interesting. Laughing.
What sound or noise do you hate?
Alarm clock.
Ah, good.
I have no idea. That was a good one.
And finally, what is your favorite food indulgence?
Oh, all right. Actually, I just made it for New Year's Day. I made a cassoulet that I added a gram of cannabis flour to, and I found this amazing whole animal butchery here in San Diego. And, you know, so I did the whole, like, wrapped the legs and the duck legs in the duck fat and marinated him overnight. And it was unbelievable. And yeah, so it was totally decadent. We laughed our asses off and it was delicious. So yeah, cassoulet infused with cannabis.
Yeah. So you cheated on the duck confit. Did you find Toulouse sausage?
No, I had to cheat on that too. And it was still okay.
It's got to be okay. It's a beans and a ton of fat. What's not to love?
Right? I know. It's like, that's what I was trying, because someone was like, okay, I wanted to make that, but I wanted to use black eyed peas. I was like, fine.
Oh, no.
Why not?
I don't mind some innovation, but to me, it's got to be the nice big fat white beans and, oh, God. Oh.
Yeah. But I mean, so I did, I still did the confit as well. I did both.
Good for you.
Yeah. Just for you. But yeah, I mean, it's one of those that you tell people what you're making, they're like, oh my God, but it's so good.
It is. It's so good. If you make enough confit, you have some for the next couple months. So.
Oh, exactly. Exactly. I do.
Very well. Good. I'm coming over. I'll be there in a few minutes.
Excellent.
Well, Robin, this has been a pleasure. How can people find you? You have a website or something that you want to direct people to find your information?
I do. So my personal website is robingriggslawrence.com. So it's RobinGriggsLawrence. LawrenceE.com. And that'll kind of get you to my other, I'm Robin Lawrence on Twitter, and it's cannabis_kitchen on Instagram. So those are kind of the best ways to find me.
Excellent. And I will put a show notes page up when this episode airs. It will be culinarylibertarian.com/17.
Awesome.
And have all of that information plus a link to your book and all the ways that people can get a hold of you. Robin, thank you very much for your time today. It's been a pleasure.
Dan, that was great. Thank you.
You're so welcome.
Take care. Bye.
Bye-bye. All right, folks, that's going to do it for today. If you, like Robin, want to make some cassoulet in the throes of this cold, frigid winter, well, I have an opportunity for you. Go to culinarylibertarian.com/stew. And pick up a cassoulet kit from D'Artagnan, one of my affiliates. Duck confit and beans is a delicious thing any time of the year, but especially so when it's cold. Check out all of Robin's links and her book, The Cannabis Kitchen Cookbook, at the show notes page, culinarylibertarian.com/17. Have a great week, and I'll see you soon. All right, so that's out. Thank you very much for your time. It went a little faster than I thought, but that's okay.
Okay. Is that all right? Good. So there's no set time that you had to fill? Or
no, it's my thing, so I can do what I want.
Awesome. I like that. That is absolutely sweet.
Well, so you mentioned liver, which,
yeah,
which was funny to me because a few episodes ago, I talked with a biochemist about fat and sugar in the diet, because I was trying to get some more information on this, and he is a big advocate for eating liver, finding a way to hide it in foods because of its healthful properties. I sort of chuckle a little bit when your least favorite food was liver. Made me think of Kyle a little bit.
That's really funny. Yeah, now my parents used to try to make us eat that stuff, and that's just doesn't seem right to me.
I like it, but it has to be done properly. And
right.
My mother was a fine cook. She raised three kids well. I wouldn't say that she was a great cook. I think if she were here, she'd agree. But the one thing, two things she could not cook was fresh fish and liver. And so we have a funny, well, we have an interesting and amusing family anecdote story about liver and my younger brother, which it's it went as bad could go.
Well, that to me is how it goes with liver.
So he promised if I eat this bite, something's going to happen. He was commanded to eat the bite, and his prediction was right.
Oh, no. Right at the table? That's funny. That's funny. Yes.
Yeah, I'm just trying to, it's lunchtime somewhere.
Nice. Very nice. Yes. Cool. And so the best is when you post just whenever you get around to it, there's no like regular like always on Wednesdays or anything like that?
Trying to see my calendar, probably shooting for the 14th of January as an air date. I've got one scheduled. I post on Mondays.
Perfect. Okay, good.
And I got a short one that I just did all as a onesie on Harmony, mostly in the kitchen. But that was, I sort of had an interesting germ of an idea from somebody in one of my baking groups. And So harmony and order and discipline, but just trying to find the yin and the yang of life in the kitchen. And I will send you a link, and you may do with it as you wish. Put it up on your sites and stuff like that. That'd be great.
I will totally do that. Absolutely.
Awesome.
Yes.
Fabulous.
Yes. All right.
Well, I learned more than I expected to learn, and I expected to learn a lot. So you taught me things that I couldn't even have anticipated. So I appreciate that.
Well, that was really fun. I really appreciate you having me on.
My pleasure. Thank you very much. Have a good afternoon.